Some of you may know that Kathy and I were in New Orleans last weekend for the wedding of our godson. It was a grand affair as weddings go, but we did not know until we discovered in New Orleans that Cajun weddings take the festivities up several notches. Our godson married a woman whose last name is Boudreaux, so the festivities span several days with a series of soirees that lead up to the wedding day and the wedding service, which is rather brief, only about 15 minutes, fulfilling its statutory and ritual purposes in short order. And then the second line forms. Have you heard of second lines? You may know it from the traditional second lines connected to New Orleans funerals, where the procession of mourners form behind the jazz band to parade through the neighborhood. It originally came as a tradition from West Africa, but it has become a quintessential art form in the city of New Orleans and in that region. What I didn't know until last Saturday was that second lines form at New Orleans weddings too. The newlyweds carry ornate parasols and form the head of procession with the jazz band. The wedding gifts are given white handkerchiefs as they fall in behind and form the second line, dancing through the neighborhood, following the drumbeat and the trumpet and the spinning parasols that can be seen up ahead. The police stop all the traffic. Neighbors come out from their houses and join in the street dance. It was all a sight to see. What I didn't know also is that it serves a functional purpose of getting the wedding party out of a wedding hall so that they can reset it for the party that then ensues for hours upon hours. Kathy and I called it quits about 5 hours later. Now, as I'm standing here saying all of this, I will tell you that as we participated in that second line that day, as fun and delightful and joyful as it was with the people whom we love and know and their families, it also felt a bit like some cultural appropriation for me. I suspect some of you may be wondering that now too. But I will tell you, in the conversations that I had that evening and that weekend, I was told in no uncertain terms by the black musicians who led us in that second line, these black artists in New Orleans, they do not see it as such. What they said was that we all need such rituals of hope and blessing. The black musicians are leading the way and we fall in line, but we are consummately a community in the moment. And they said, we are invited into that for a purpose. Now, it got me to thinking, though, whom do we choose to follow in this life? And here on this last Sunday of the church year, when we observe Christ the King Sunday, the question becomes even more nuanced. Whom do we choose to follow in this life? Christ the King Sunday is not an ancient tradition of the church, arising only as a quasi-feast day in the church calendar about a century ago, but the image of King as the one whom people follow is ancient and universal. Indeed, it is archetypal, which in Jungian psychology terms is to say it is present in the collective unconscious of all human beings, regardless of gender. Archetypes form the common foundation for our experiences. Now, I need to pause here and say, this parish cathedral is committed to the work of expansive liturgical language, which is to say, we do not want to define God only by masculine images and Jesus by such as well. But neither are we saying that we need to expunge all of it as if we could, but rather we are expanding on it in rich and dynamic and life-giving ways. So as I talk about king in archetypal language, I ask you to hang with me here. We're talking about archetype, the collective unconscious of all human beings. And the mature king archetype is defined and represented as the one who is centered, who is decisive, who is the one about blessing and protecting those with whom he or she or they care for in really pastorally dynamic ways. They provide order amidst the chaos of life. They provide integrity into the milieu of life in their realm. And they're always seeking to inspire creativity in others. I hope you hear in that a certain generosity of spirit and a stewardship of everyone. The problem is, I think, that the tragically misguided version of king, which all too often finds expressions across history and certainly in current events, is one who is either immaturely narcissistic and in desperation turns tyrannical, or is weak to a fault and becomes paranoid or even delusional at the prospect of their losing power. And if either of those are playing out, violence is not far behind. Violence becomes the pressure valve in the face of such shadows. And friends, history is strewn with wars with origins in such misanthropic distortions of the king archetype. But that doesn't mean we should jettison the image of king altogether in our liturgies or in our lives, even if we could. The archetype, however you might name it, king, monarch, royal, regal, whatever gender you envision with that, is with us, is in all of us. One attribute given to Jesus is the meek king. Now, I know the notion of meekness has largely been lost in our modern lexicon, or we just simply degrade it to meekness is weakness, an anemic version that has little hope of leading others, certainly not others wanting to follow. I don't think for a second that's who Jesus was. No, Jesus, the meek king, was meek in the sense of that centered, that decisive, that ability to be blessing and always offering the pastoral support and attention, providing the order amidst the chaos, the hope against the despair, the integrity to life for those who are wearied by the powers and principalities of their time. He offered a different way that resonated deeply, and I think still does. And in the quintessential art form that is the Paschal mystery, death and resurrection are held together by Jesus' kingly creative power that invites us all into a procession of hope to follow him into the new realm, a new vision of life. There is surely generosity of spirit in that, and surely stewardship for the whole in his invitation to follow him, but always, or should I say, never denying the vagaries of life that are ever present on the way. But here on this Christ the King Sunday, there is an even more radical twist to this notion of Christ as King, this archetypal image of Christ as King. And I'll turn to a woman, a priest, Fleming Rutledge, one of the first female priests ordained in the Episcopal Church, not one of the original Philadelphia 11, but in the second cohort after that in 1977, and she is still regarded as one of the finest preachers of our time. I would say she's one of the finest writers of our time. Fleming Rutledge, I commend her to you. But she, citing the gospel passage we hear this morning, wrote of Jesus our King in this way: "The one who sits upon the throne is the same one who, at the very apex of his cosmic power, reveals that the universe turns on a cup of water given to the littlest ones in his name." The universe turns upon a cup of water given to the littlest ones in his name. Folks, I want to follow that King. And I bet more often than not, he will not look the same as me. She will speak regal grace into our midst in a language that is not likely my first. They will show up in our lives when we need them most. And in it all, we will recognize them and their invitation to meekness amidst the paschal mystery of life. And in that moment, we can dance with the regal one and know it to be right and good and true. May it be so.